A couple of years ago, I was doing some training work with a major insurance company, and the subject of follow-up arose. I pointed out to them that in spite of paying them several thousand dollars as a client over the previous few years, the only contact I had ever had from their office had been my renewal statement. Then I told them that in some respects, my dog was treated better than I. Let me explain. Some years ago, my dog, Winston, needed a vet. My wife took him to the nearest local animal hospital. They took care of his problem and sent him home with some tablets. A few months later, we moved into a new house some 30 miles away. Now, I'm sure you've all had the same experience when you move into a new home. You get truckloads of junk mail from realtors, insurance agents, landscape contractors, and charities, all vying for a piece of your disposable income. However, I had to admit of being surprised when I found a letter addressed to Winston Wood. I'd never really thought about Winston as having a last name. I showed it to my wife and commented that somebody at somebody's headquarters must really be screwed up if they'd started sending junk mail to dogs. Imagine trying to sell my dog life insurance or enticing him to take out another Visa card. However, I opened the envelope on Winston's behalf. I discovered that it was no mistake. The contents were indeed intended for Winston Wood. Inside was a birthday card from the animal hospital. Immediately, I felt a little guilty. I had no idea it was his birthday, so I jumped in the car, rushed down to the store, and picked him up a juicy bone. My wife and I laughed, put the card on our coffee table, and told all our friends about the incident. Over the next few months, Winston and my other dog, Sally, received several additional pieces of mail, all addressed to them personally. There were get-well cards after their shots, Christmas cards, and believe it or not, Winston even received a 1040 dog form at income tax time. The form was laid out like the typical 1040, only with questions that are a little more dog pertinent. In fact, let me share a couple of them with you. Filing status: stray dog, family dog, top dog, or underdog. Exemptions for dependents: check all dependents, fleas, ticks, worms, ear mites, other dependents. Right at the bottom, where you fill in the balance due, it says your total tax bite is. So despite the fact that my wife and I now live 30 miles from Laguna Hills Animal Hospital, and the fact that there are 20 other vets that are closer, all staffed with fine, caring doctors, guess where we take our dogs? Got it in one. And you know what? My dog gets more mail than I do. You. Now that's pretty scary, isn't it? But you are, quite simply, the person in control of your own destiny. Whatever path in life you choose will be your free choice for better or worse. There is no one to blame for failure or to praise for success but you. The 7th Cavalry will not come charging across the hill to your rescue if things don't go as planned. Neither will Superman or the knight in shining armor on a white horse who used to save you as a child. It's up to you and you alone. President Harry Truman had a plaque on his desk in the White House that read, "The buck stops here." Make that your first resolve on the road to the top. Do not blame outside forces whenever things go wrong in your life. That's what people who don't succeed do. Face the facts. Somehow, whether through poor planning, lack of action, procrastination, or a thousand other reasons, the blame comes directly back to you. Decide here and now that you are in charge of your own destiny and your own life. You don't need anyone else's permission to change your life. You don't have to plug away at a job you hate. You don't have to live in the same town or associate with the same people. If you feel you should be somewhere else or doing something differently, you can, without anyone's permission, leave. This is America. You can do whatever you want. The only person who has any power to stop you is you. Conquering your own mind is the first and biggest step to getting ahead in life. In the spring of 1954, a young medical student at Oxford University entered a shoe shop in Wimbledon near London and asked the cobbler to make him a special pair of running shoes.
He wanted them light and strong enough to last just 12 laps. The cobbler provided such a shoe, and the young man improved them further by fitting them with special graphite spikes. These spikes gave him better traction than the metal ones commonly used because the graphite would slip more easily in and out of the cinder track on which he ran. The young man knew that preparation and planning were key elements in reaching his goal, just as they are in any successful endeavor. They were, however, only part of the ingredients needed for what would soon be known as the Miracle Mile. The young man discovered that the hardest part of reaching his goal was not running the 1 mile distance on the cinder track. It was conquering the 6-inch space between his ears. When Roger Bannister finally broke the 4-minute mile on May 6, 1954, people had been trying to run a mile in under 4 minutes for almost 2,000 years. Since the time of the ancient games at the foot of Mount Olympus, runners had reached towards what seemed like an impossible goal. Athletes had run in the Olympics, in international championships, and around the world, yet no one at the highest level, with gold medals and world records on the line, had ever run a mile in less than 4 minutes. In fact, many of the coaches of Bannister's era actually believed that the attempt could well result in the death of the runner, thinking that the physical limits of human performance had been reached. If God had wanted man to be faster, they reasoned, he would have given him 4 legs instead of 2. Nevertheless, within just a few weeks of Bannister's record-breaking run, several other runners had run the mile in less than 4 minutes. How was this possible? Did the entire human race suddenly get faster in the summer of 1954? Of course not. The answer is much simpler. And that is the first key in making it big. The answer, pure and simple, is that there was a mental limitation on the part of the runners. Because no one else had ever done it, the world's greatest athletes, either consciously or subconsciously, did not believe it could be done. In their minds, they reasoned that man had simply met the limits of speed and endurance a few seconds short of the 4-minute mile. Once this fact had been proven wrong, runners across the globe decided that if Roger Bannister could run a mile in 4 minutes, well, so could they. If Bannister had looked at the record books or spoken to all those others who had tried before him, he would simply have given up his quest and never reached it. But he did not let other people's views or the supposed facts in the record books influence his resolve to succeed. He shed off limitations and went after his goal with a single-minded purpose that made him famous. In fact, his picture even graced the very first issue of Sports Illustrated. I'm sure you've experienced the very same phenomenon in one small way or another. I know I have. One very vivid mental breakthrough I can remember was as a kid of 15 playing golf. At the time, I was playing 3.5 rounds a day, 63 holes. Although I ate, drank, and slept golf, I could not shoot under par for any given 9. Almost every day, I played 9 holes in even par, but it seemed impossible for me to play just 1 shot better. This went on all summer. Finally, one day, at the end of the summer, I was playing the 9th hole even par when I missed the green and put my ball in a sand trap. I figured it was another disappointment. But then, out of nowhere, I hold my trap shot out for a birdie to go 1 under par. From that day on, I was able to play at least 9 holes under par on a very consistent basis. Now it's your turn. Picture for a moment some of your own mental barriers, the defeated ones. Think back right now. What are some of the things that you have done that at one time just didn't seem possible? Have you lost weight or stopped smoking? Earned a degree, or started your own business. Perhaps you've moved to a totally new part of the country. Think of the mental barriers you have conquered, no matter how small, and put that power to work in your life to help you remove the bigger mental barriers of achieving success. Once these mental barriers are conquered, it becomes easy, but the real rewards only go to those people who break the barriers quickly. Break out of all your mind's limitations. If you feel you are lacking in some of the skills you need to achieve your goals, you can pick them up as you go along. The important thing is to break your mental barriers right now. When I was 14 years old, I picked up a matchbox on which were written the words, "Someone is always doing what someone else said could not be done."
Those words have stuck with me ever since, and I've repeated them regularly to those who say it can't. Can you imagine how ridiculous it must have seemed to think of actually putting a man on the moon at the beginning of World War II, just 30 years before it was to become a reality? They were still using wooden biplanes, yet someone dreamed that man could land on the moon and set about trying to make that dream come true. How to attract luck into your life like a high-powered magnet. Luck is the residue of design. Branch Rickey. You often hear people say that the main way to get ahead in life is to meet the right people, that you have to be in the right place at the right time in order to make any solid progress in life, that you have to be very lucky to get promoted, to get noticed, or to become wealthy. In fact, most people feel they actually have very little control over the events in their lives. The great scheme of things has somehow robbed them of the right to meet the type of people or discover the opportunities that could contribute to their success. They feel that fate has dealt them a losing hand and that, in effect, luck is simply not on their side. Luck, to these people, is a strange and mystic phenomenon that avoids them like the plague and bestows itself on others. This, of course, is just not true. There are a few things simply beyond your control, but 99% of luck lies directly in your hands. Other people can, of course, be a great help in assisting you reach your goals, and there are many ways that you can go about bringing these people into your life. The opportunities others typically regard as lucky can also be brought directly into your path through careful planning and action. I'm truly amazed by the number of people who think that their luck is either bad or totally non-existent. If luck were indeed a 50-50 proposition like the toss of a coin, then half the people in the world would get it while the other half would not. In that case, the chances of you being a lucky person would be 1 out of 2. If this were the case, there would be a lot more people around who think of themselves as lucky. A full 75% of the population now seem to think they are unlucky in some way. A large portion of them must be wrong, for if we subscribe to the toss of the coin theory, everyone wins at least 50% of the time. The truth of the matter is, your luck can be improved far above this average figure. What is luck? Luck, in short, is the crossroads where planning meets opportunity. If you miss an important interview because your car develops a flat tire, is that bad luck? Not if you've been driving around on ball tires without a spare for 6 weeks. Not if you didn't leave early enough to get a taxi or hitch a ride in case of emergency. Not if you have no money in your pocket to make a phone call or pay a cab. In these cases, it becomes just poor planning and poor judgment, not bad luck. If you have developed no plan, set forth no strategies, complete with backup ideas and strategies, and taken no positive action to move you towards your goals, all of which we'll discuss later, you simply cannot meet opportunity. Therefore, you cannot increase your chances of being lucky to any significant degree. If, on the other hand, you have done some or all of these things, your chances of being lucky are greatly enhanced. When South African golfer Gary Player first came over to the United States in the late 1950s, he quickly started beating many of the home players. Soon he developed a reputation among them for being a lucky player. Like countless people do when they are faced with someone who is more successful than they are, many of the tour's regular pros simply decided that the reason Gary Player was winning was that he was simply luckier than they were. How to effectively use goals to propel you towards success. If you read the biographies of successful people, like the late Sam Walton, who is America's richest man with a personal fortune of over $8 billion. Lee Iacocca, Winston Churchill, Tiger Woods, or almost any prominent person in sports, business, or politics, you will find they all had one thing in common. They, along with all others at the very top of their fields, set goals. Each one of these exceptional people had a very clear picture of what they ultimately wanted to have happen in their life. They knew exactly who they wanted to become and what they wanted to accomplish. They then set out to determine the steps and actions they would have to follow in order to reach these goals. Goal setting is the first step you must take in order to move into the 5% of people who are at the very top of their field. The only goals most people in this country have are to pay the rent and make the car payment. Sure, they'd like to make more money and enjoy the respect of others, but they are not prepared to commit the time or the effort, although it demands little of either, to write their goals and draw a map for their future. The chances are that as you listen to this program, you've already heard or read something about the value of setting written goals. Despite this fact, the chances are you probably do not have a clear or extensive set written down. In fact, studies show that less than 3% of people in the country have taken the time to write out their goals in detail and develop an action plan to move them towards them. Why is this? Some people do not write down their goals because they're afraid that if they do, they will have to face that fear of all fears, failure. There is something about committing your goals to paper that makes them cast in stone. You can't wriggle out of something that is right there in front of you in black and white. If, for any reason, you did not accomplish these goals, you can't tell yourself that you didn't really want it or that you didn't mean it. The proof is irrefutable. By not writing down their goals, people feel as if they do not have to face the possibility of failure. After all, if it's not written down, who's to know you ever wanted it in the first place? The second reason people do not commit their goals to paper is because they don't have any goals, or at least not any clear ones. If this is the case, then you must make the decision about what you really want out of life. What is it you would do if money were no object? If you could spend your life doing whatever you like to do, what would it be? Would you travel the world or spend your days fishing? If the genie from the lamp suddenly appeared and gave you 3 wishes, how would you use them to change your life? What would constitute your ideal day? How exactly would you like to spend your time given no constraints? Another method to bring this process into sharp focus is to ask yourself this question. What would you do in the next 12 months if you knew it was the last year of your life? What would you see, do, and achieve in that time? Whatever the answers are to these questions, they should lead you to developing a list of activities that could well be turned into goals. They should be the things that really matter in your life, the things that by accomplishing them will let you gain the greatest sense of self-fulfillment and achievement. The final reason that many people do not set written goals is that no one has clearly described the value of doing this in such a way as to cause action. I can tell you right up front though, if you do not take the 10 to 15 minutes it takes to fill out the goals section in your workbook, you will have little chance of getting where you want to go. How can you if you don't know where you're going? The answer is very clear. You simply can't. Going through life without goals is like getting in your car this minute and setting off for Transylvania, Arkansas without ever having consulted a map. Your chances of showing up there without getting hopelessly lost are very small. I know, I was hopelessly lost when I found it. But seriously, in a nutshell, goals have the same power as a good roadmap. Let's say you are given the chance to enter a treasure hunt that has a $1 million cash prize for the winner. There are 9 other people in the contest. The treasure is buried somewhere in Yellowstone National Park. 9 of you are given certain vague clues as to where the treasure might be located. You are told it can be found within sight of the tallest peak, that is, close to an area popular with bears, and that it's off the main road. All of these clues lead you to a 20-mile circle in the very center of the park. It's not a lot to go on, but it's a start.
The 10th person is given a map. The map has all the roads, rivers, and mountains. It also has all the major landmarks and, as the ultimate aid, a clear picture of where the treasure is actually buried. You are all dropped off in different locations at the very perimeter of the park. Who do you think is going to find the treasure first? Obviously, the person with a map. So let me ask you another question. Do you feel giving the 10th person a map was an unfair advantage? Most people would have to agree that it was. And yet, that's exactly the same type of advantage enjoyed by people who have written goals and action plans they can follow. It's also exactly the type of advantage over others you will enjoy when you've completed this section. The simple act of writing down your goals will vault you to the top echelon of people in the country and increase your chances of making it big by 100, maybe even 1,000%. I consider myself very fortunate in that since I was 7 years old, I've had very clear goals. I've always known what I wanted from my life. Although I've found it necessary to adjust my intermediate goals from time to time, I've never lost sight of them. When I was about 10 years old, a man in our neighborhood bought a new Porsche Carrera. It was jet black with the Carrera letters running up the side in large gold script. It was the very first Porsche that I'd ever seen, and I knew it was the car I had to have. When I was about 15 years old and almost old enough to drive, a friend of mine's father gave me a ride home in his brand new Porsche 928S. I immediately knew that this was the Porsche I wanted. It was the fastest, smoothest ride I had ever experienced. I made it my goal that night, right there and then, to have one. I did not know at the time how I was going to achieve this goal, but I knew it would happen. To start things off in the right direction, I put Porsche pictures all over my wall. I read all the literature on the 928 I could find, how fast they were, where they were made, etc. At the age of 27, I finally bought one and even paid cash. Goals work. As soon as I started my own business, I had the same goal as most Americans, owning my own home. I wanted a large house with unique modern architecture, a house with high ceilings and an open floor plan. This house would also have lots of glass and a huge bathroom with a hot tub with large open spaces, ideal for entertaining my friends. Within 3 years, I bought my first home for a little over $400,000, and I got just what I wanted. The bottom line is this. The clearer your goals are in your mind, the easier it is for you to reach them. I used this principle during my first year in business. I decided that although statistics show that 90% of all businesses fail, I was going to make $100,000 my very first year. I had never before in my life made that kind of money. In fact, I had never made more than a few thousand dollars in a single year, so it seemed like a lofty goal. However, not only did I achieve my goal, but I even exceeded $100,000. This just verified my belief in goals and the magic they work in your life. You can make goals work for you, too. Goals focus not only the conscious mind, but the subconscious mind as well on a specific target. Once your mind is focused on this target, it will do all in its power to help you reach it. This is due in part to your mind now knowing exactly what you want and recognizing people and opportunities that will help you achieve your goals. Have you ever bought a new car or a different colored car thinking it was pretty unique, only to suddenly find every other car you saw on the road was the same model or color? The only thing that changed was that your brain was now aware of that color and that model and so recognized them more often. So it is with goals. Once they are set, your mind will suddenly start to see opportunities and ways in which the goals can be accomplished. Goals ultimately become the roadmap of your destiny and give your mind a clear and focused path on which to travel to help you reach your dreams. To make goal setting work well, you must follow a few simple rules. Firstly, you must make your goals very specific. If you want to buy a house this year, don't just say, "My goal is to have a house this year." Look through the newspapers and the real estate magazines and actually find the one you want or one that's very similar to it. Go and see the home, walk through it. Make your house more real for your mind to focus on by putting pictures of this house on your refrigerator or in your office. Describe in detail your new home and how having it will make you feel. Will it be in a new upscale neighborhood with a country club? Will it be large and spacious with vaulted ceilings and lots of light? Or old with stained glass windows to show off all your antiques? You should know exactly how many rooms your new house has, the number of windows, what color it's painted, and as many other details as you possibly can. The more detailed and specific you make your goals, the more you will do in order to achieve them. Make them real, and you will be surprised just how quickly they will happen. Focusing on your goals in this way makes your subconscious mind focus on reaching the goal. In addition to zeroing in on the goals, you also focus on the feelings you're going to experience and the importance of attaining these goals. This helps to motivate you to do the things that are necessary to actually make the goal become a reality. The human brain is an incredibly powerful and amazing piece of equipment, yet we only use a fraction of its vast resources. The brain will do only what you command it to do. If you tell your brain that your goal is to have a new 4-bedroom house in the nice part of town, it will attempt everything in its power to help you get that house. If, however, you send a message to your brain that you would like that house, but you'd also like to know all the reasons why you can't have it, your brain will also comply. It will provide you with all kinds of reasons why you can't get that house and work overtime to provide you with still more. The brain only does what you ask it to do. Ask it to help you find ways to the top, and that's exactly what the brain will do. Ask it to provide you with excuses to sabotage your success, and it will also do a stunning job. Be very, very specific when defining your goals. The second thing you must do and consider when setting goals is to make sure that they are congruent with your other goals, beliefs, and values. Goals must be congruent with your true beliefs in order to propel you forward. You will not reach your goal of making $1 million in sales this year if you know the computer equipment you are selling is useless and constantly breaks down. If you have any type of integrity at all, your subconscious mind will sabotage you from making that many sales. At a recent seminar in Canada, a young man told me that within 3 years he wanted to buy a new Ferrari, a 3-bedroom house on a nearby lake, and a boat. Now the young man had a growing business and was full of energy, enthusiasm, and the will to work. There was no doubt in my mind that although lofty, his goals were well within the realms of possibility. However, he also stated that making $50,000 a year in income would be fine by him. Here's a perfect example of incongruent goals. You can't buy a $200,000 car, a $300,000 home, and a $30,000 boat if you only make $50,000 a year. Had he moved forward without correcting this mindset, he would not have had any chance to reach his goals because he was just as confused about what he wanted after he wrote his goals down as before. Together, we went back through his goals and reevaluated them so that they fit together in a congruent manner. An example of incongruent mindset sabotaging success is to set a goal to make enough money in your present job, which you hate, in order to bail out and do something you truly like. You have far more chance of attaining your goals if you stop doing something you hate now and challenge your energy into doing something you enjoy. I have lived through this myself. Tired and bored with a business I had founded, I drifted aimlessly for 12 months before I finally took the plunge and sold out. I had no idea exactly how I would replace the income, which was substantial, but I did it. I sold and jumped off into the deep end, hoping I could swim. Not only did I swim, but I also began to have more fun than ever. It was as if a giant weight had been lifted from my shoulders. Instantly, I became more creative and began to follow opportunities that were of far more interest to me than my previous business had been. When you do what you truly love, something magical happens to your creativity and energy. The third rule you should follow in setting goals is to make sure the goals you set are measurable. Saying that you want to be happy or well off are not measurable goals. You must set goals that allow you to check and see how you're progressing towards them. When you set intangible goals, you cannot measure them, and so they remain distant and untouchable. They will not serve to motivate you into action. Instead, they will simply take the form of an idle daydream. You must be able to set up some way in which you can track your progress in time, money, or weight loss. Before we get into your plan, let's take stock and see exactly where you are now. In order to do this, we must analyze your SWOT, or your strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. To illustrate how to use SWOT to analyze your strategy, we'll look at a hypothetical situation. Let's say your ultimate goal in life is to climb Mount Everest. You want to make it to the very top in record time. You've set your goal and you're ready to plan your strategy. You've come up with the following basic SWOT. Strengths. You've climbed several of the other major mountains in the Himalayas and so have a great deal of experience and practical knowledge. Weakness. Your best teammate has had to fly back home because of the illness of his father and is unlikely to return in time for the expedition. Opportunities. The timing is great. It happens to be the 50th anniversary of Hillary's first climb up the mountain. The weather outlook is good, and a major network is willing to sponsor the climb and film it. Threats. The government of the area is unstable and often creates last-minute problems. A team of Japanese climbers is all set to make a similar attempt 2 weeks later. This means the record time must be fast enough to withstand this challenge. Going up in record time will mean taking less equipment, which will increase the danger. Once you have analyzed your SWOT, you're ready to plan your goal-achieving strategies. Taking into account the results of your SWOT, you can plan your strategies around your weakness and play only to your strengths. Conversely, you can take direct action to shore up your weakness. If, for example, you felt that another climber with your experience was really needed for the test, you could start off by finding him. Once you've discovered exactly where you are now, you're ready to begin your action strategy. These are the actions, tasks, and jobs you must accomplish in order to reach your goal. Let's look at the actions you will have to take in order to reach the goal of climbing Mount Everest. 1. You must secure permission to climb the mountain from the Tibetan government and obtain entry visas and travel documents. 2. You must obtain several million dollars to fund the climb. A network has provided half of this amount, but you must secure the rest. 3. You must assemble a team of the top climbers in the nation. 4. You must gather together all the tents, ropes, and climbing equipment you will need. 5. You must book plane reservations and ground transportation to get you to Kathmandu. 6. You must obtain a team of Sherpa guides to help your team and carry its equipment up the mountain. 7. You must obtain sufficient supplies of food and medical provisions to last throughout the expedition. 8. You must obtain the best maps, charts, and notes that are available from previous expeditions. Once your actions have been written down in black and white, you must then decide which one of them is the limiting factor. Which is the action or skill that is needed in order to allow all the other things to fall into place? You must identify this limiting step and take action on it first, or it will halt your progress. In the case of the Everest expedition, the limiting factor will actually be obtaining the difficult and regulation-bound Tibetan government's permission to enter the country. Without addressing this issue first, all of your other efforts will be wasted. You could spend months gathering the needed equipment and funds only to find you're not even allowed to set foot in the country. Once all of your actions have been listed, you must turn to the actual tactics you will employ in order to make your action plan a reality. Specifically, how will you handle each of these actions in order to ensure they're carried out correctly? Take the first action item or limiting step in the goal of climbing Everest, that of gaining permission from the Tibetan government. What tasks are involved in accomplishing this mission? Break it down into specific tasks, such as who will get the permission, how long will it take, how much will it cost, and where does one go to get such permission? You decide that this important step will be handled personally by you. You call the State Department in Washington to find out who you must ask for visas. You discover it takes 3 months and costs several thousand dollars and can be done through the Tibetan Embassy in Washington. You then outline a sub-strategy for bringing this task to completion. The third and final part of setting your action strategy is logistics. Do you have the resources of money, personnel, and equipment to make it to your goal? If not, they must be found before you start out or picked up along the way to ensure your success.
To climb Mount Everest, the party must have the latest climbing equipment, boots, oxygen tanks, tents, etc. Now that you have a basic idea of how to turn your goals into reality by using an action plan, let's develop a specific one for your own personal goals. Set aside a weekend or an afternoon in a place where you're not going to be disturbed. Drive to the mountains if you have to, but find a place and concentrate on thinking through the actions you must take to actualize your goals. First, take out your notebooks and let's analyze your SWOT carefully and honestly. What are your unique strengths? Are you a good salesperson? A good leader? Good with your hands? What are the things that you do best? Next, you must answer the question, what are your weaknesses? Are you unorganized? A procrastinator? In what areas do you feel you need improvement? Thirdly, what are the opportunities? Are there promotions in the winds, new markets to conquer, or new businesses that are needed? What opportunities do you have now? Finally, what are the threats? Are there others with a good chance for this promotion? What is the competition for the new business you have planned? And what are the potential for problems? Once you have analyzed your SWOT, you are ready to plan your goal-achieving strategies. Taking into account the results of your SWOT, you can plan your strategies around your strengths and play only to them. Knowing what they are, you can take direct action to minimize your weaknesses. If, for example, you need better sales skills in order to achieve your goal for business growth, you can seek better training for yourself. You can also hire the services of a skilled salesperson. Either way, you lessen the threat from a weakness in a key area. Open up your workbook to your list of 10 major goals and pick one. Under it, list all the actions you will need to take from start to finish in order to achieve this goal. Once your list of actions is complete, you must analyze it carefully to determine which action is the limiting factor. Very often people rush off into projects without identifying their limiting factor. They spend time working hard on parts of the projects that are eventually held up by other factors that should have been tackled first. For example, if you're an immigrant to America from a country in which English was not spoken, and you want to make it big, your limiting factor is often your inability to speak English. You can only go so far without a command of the language. Everything else you do should take second place to learning English as quickly and as thoroughly as possible. If you want to start your own business, your limiting factor is often your ability to attract customers and get them to buy your product or service. If you lack marketing savvy and sales skills, all your other knowledge and skills will be wasted until you learn or improve in these crucial and limiting areas. Or perhaps your limiting factor is lack of cash, too many government regulations, or the 101 other things that crop up. Whatever your limiting factor is, act on it first, and you will smooth the way ahead and make true progress towards your goals. Take your list of steps that must be taken in order to achieve your first goal and write down what limiting factor must be overcome before reaching your first goal. What one step must be accomplished before any other steps can be taken. Once the limiting factor has been identified, go back through your list and prioritize the other actions. What is the second most important factor, the third, and so on. In this way, you build a clear picture in your mind of what actions must be taken and in what order the actions must be done to help you reach your goals.
Investing in your greatest asset. Let me start by asking you a very important question. How much are you worth? I don't mean how much do you wish you were getting paid. I mean if you were in your boss's position, what would be a fair salary to pay you based on your skills, talents, and performance? Would it be less than you're getting now? Or would it be more than you're getting now? How much more would it be? 10%, 20%, maybe even 50%?
Now, if you said yes, as most people do, you should be making more money. Stop for a minute and put yourself back in your boss's position. Think from his or her point of view and justify why you should get paid more. Almost everyone feels that they are underpaid. But just because someone else in the office makes more money than you do, or because you show up on time every day, is not a good enough reason to justify a raise. Take a moment right now to take out your workbook and list 5 reasons as to why you should be paid more. If you own your own business, do this as if you are the boss. For example, is your experience worth more? Have you added to your inventory of skills by taking courses or reading books important to your industry? Have you increased your sales or level of customer satisfaction? It is now believed that the growth of technology is at such a fever-pitched pace that in order to stay on top of any field, you must double your knowledge every 7 years. A large percentage of the population stopped trying to learn anything the moment they left high school or college, let alone double their knowledge. This, of course, is a great shame because high school or college offers nothing more than a very rudimentary coverage of the basic skills needed to succeed, if in fact it even offers that. Think of your mind and the knowledge and skills it contains as you think of your body. What would happen to you physically if all you ate each day were large, jelly-filled donuts? If on top of that you cut down your exercise to zero and drank only chocolate milkshakes? Within a very short period of time, you would gain a huge amount of weight and be physically incapable of even simple activities. Your health would fail rapidly, and eventually you might even die. If, on the other hand, you eat 3 balanced meals a day, work out regularly, and sleep 8 hours each night, the chances are you will wake up feeling great each day. You will live a long, healthy, productive life. By investing in your body in the form of eating the right foods and exercising regularly, you maintain your body in good shape. So it is with the brain. If all you feed it are sitcoms, soap operas, novels, and sensational magazines, you are in effect giving it jelly donuts for food. If the only parts of the newspaper you read are the sports page and the comic, you are drinking high-fat chocolate milkshakes that will put on pounds and slow you down. There is a large sign on the door of my dentist's office that reads, "Ignore your teeth, and they will just go away." If you do not work out your brain by providing it with new and interesting material, you are simply letting it waste away. The less you stimulate your mind, the less inclined it becomes to help you accomplish your goals. The more you stimulate your mind, the more information it will crave, and the faster and more substantial your progress will be. The very fact that you are listening to this program means that you are making an effort to upgrade your business and personal skills. This is a great start, but don't let it end there. You should put aside time each week to work out your mind just as you do your body. Seek other books and information, attend seminars, and listen to audio tapes on a variety of topics that will aid you in your business and your life. The time and money you invest in pursuit of knowledge will be returned to you 100-fold far quicker than you ever thought possible. My friend Brian Tracy, president of Tracy Learning Systems, a company that specializes in human development and the author of many excellent programs, says the single most valuable piece of advice he ever gave anyone is to invest 3% of their income in themselves. How the most important person in the world can help you. In order to make it big in any way, you need the help of others. You need people who will lend you money. People to work with you that will help you reach your goals. If not directly by aiding your cause, then as a member of your staff or indirectly as a customer to buy your products or service. This brings us to the key skill in life, your ability to communicate with others. Getting others to do as you want, whether you pay them or not, is essential to your success. Even in an army that has a great deal of discipline, the generals with the best people skills become the giants of history, not the ones who shout the loudest. Getting people to do what you want and help you achieve your goals is easy. The problem is that very few people, even those who understand the principle, manage to practice its virtues day in and day out. All you need to know to achieve astounding success in this area is to know and understand the answer to one simple question. So here we go with the question. Who do you think is the most important person in the world? The president, a religious leader, a scientist, a sports figure, a superstar singer. What do you think? Who do you think is the most important person in the world right here and now? The answer is clear, at least to 99% of the world. The most important person in the world is the person you are talking to. The prospect, customer, friend, or foe you are presently speaking with is, to that person, the most important person in the world. It's amazing so few people ever truly realize and grasp this single fact of life. I know it took me a lot longer than it should. It seems this realization is one of those that comes only with age and experience, and even then, it often eludes all but the most astute. It came to Lincoln in his 30s, when after writing a scathing editorial about a prominent local person in the newspaper, the person challenged him to a duel to the death. Fortunately for Lincoln and the rest of America, the duel was stopped at the last second when friends of the two men intervened. From that point on, Lincoln found better and more diplomatic ways of communicating to let people know when he did not agree with their point of view. He learned and changed in his 30s. But the realization that this course of action pays huge dividends comes to others much later in life, and to many not at all. If you are a young person participating in this program, then pay close attention to this section. Understanding these principles will clearly be one of the most important lessons of your life. The earlier you grasp and understand them, the earlier they will bring home handsome rewards. Even if you're not young, it's never too late to get people on your side, and the results of doing so are always the same. You get closer to your own goals a lot faster. With rare exception, people are not interested in what you did or what you want from them. They are only interested in what you can do for them. Take the advertising representative that walked into my office and told me all the things he had done with a competitor in the martial arts business. He never stopped talking long enough about what he had done to find out that we deliberately follow a course of action that was in fact the direct opposite of theirs. Each person you meet in life has a deep subconscious desire to be treated like the most important person in the world. It has been written many times that a human's highest need is that of respect and recognition. If you let a person down in this regard, you will lose a sale, a prospect, or a relationship. Have a goal of making as many people as possible feel great each and every time you come into contact with them. Build them up, compliment them at every opportunity, and make them feel great about themselves and about their relationship with you. You will be rewarded 100-fold for your effort, and it doesn't really take much. Rid yourself of negative comments and make today the day you start talking positively about those around you. Talk only in terms of things you like and admire about people, and let others worry about criticism. A nice side effect of this action is its reaction on you. You become a much happier person. It's very easy to forget how the simple things in life can contribute dramatically to other people's perception of you and just how much they can add to your chances of success. This lesson was brought home to me one day at one of my karate schools. I was standing in the lobby when an attractive middle-aged mother brought in her son for his lessons. I was wearing a blue sweater, and she stopped briefly in front of me. As I greeted her, she said, "You know, you have the most beautiful blue eyes. You should wear blue more often." There are two key aspects to marketing yourself to your boss, clients, or customers. Know what they want, and then keep yourself in front of them at all times. That's how you create the opportunity for new jobs, promotions, and business. It also makes it far easier to succeed faster. People will not search you out like they seek out the guru on the mountain, no matter how good you are, if you do not keep your talents in constant view. Someone else will, as sure as night turns to day, be called before you are when a new opportunity arises. It really is easier to make it than to fail. The reason is that there's much more competition at the bottom than at the top. For example,
On any given job interview, there are only 5% of the people that actually stand any chance whatsoever of getting the job. 60% will be disqualified by their lack of qualifications or by a poorly written resume. That leaves just 40% to deal with. Of the 40%, 10% will not hit it off with the interviewer. 10% will not take the job because their spouse does not want to move to another area. 10% will not take the job because of kids, grandparents, or other family considerations. 3% will have some kind of black mark against them in their past, a reference that doesn't check out, a suspected drug or alcohol problem. 2% will have some form of physical problem that will work against them with the interviewer, such as a nervous twitch, a heart condition, etc. That leaves just 5% with any chance whatsoever. Many of the 5% that make it into the final interview will, because of time or some other such problem, be ill-prepared for the interview. A friend of mine just applied for the city manager's job in a large city. He was one of 12 people out of over 100 applicants who were included on the final shortlist for the job. Wanting to make a good impression at the interview, he flew into the city on the Friday night, 2 days early. The following day, his first stop was at the local library, where he set out to find as much as he possibly could about the city and its history. What he found there complemented the information he had already received by overnight mail from the local Chamber of Commerce a few days previously. He spent the next day driving around town, paying particular attention to the buildings, properties, parks, and other operations run by the city. He took detailed notes on what he saw. He talked casually with the few city employees who were working on Sunday and asked them about their jobs, the city, the management, and their problems. He spent that evening in his room reading through the various local newspapers he'd picked up during the day. They proved to be a great help in bringing to his attention the various issues that were at the forefront in the local area. A new garbage dump and a proposed prison were unpopular. Local residents favored closing the dump and moving the prison to a site, a larger tract of unincorporated land north of the city. On a good note, the head of the school board was receiving national attention and praise for his involvement in an anti-drug program. A third item of interest was that a local community within the city was holding a town meeting to discuss forming its own city. At the interview the next day, the committee thought he was surprisingly well informed, and he was offered the job a few days later. In this short time, however, he'd been presented with another opportunity and so turned down the position. But before he did, he had a long discussion with the head of the interview panel. He wanted to know, for his future reference, why they had chosen him over the other applicants. It came as no surprise that the reason they'd chosen him over several higher-profile applicants was that he was the only person that applied for the job who knew the first thing about the city or its problems. Several of the other applicants did not even have the slightest idea of the city's population, major industries, or geographic size when asked. Think about that. 12 top people applying for the same job, but only one took the trouble to find out about the city. Yes, making it big really is easier than struggling along with the masses at the bottom. The first rule of marketing is to know your market. Find out everything you can about your job, business, boss, customers, company, city, state, and any other key information that may aid you in meeting their specific needs. To do this is often as easy as going to your local library. Check out a volume of Who's Who to find out about the important people in your area. Check business registers to find out the name of key executives and companies. Check with the local Chamber of Commerce to find out about a specific area and its history. If you don't know who or what the market for your talents or service is, ask. Try this on Monday morning for a quick boost to your career and a clear definition of your market area. Go into your boss's office and ask, "What could I do this day, week, or month to make myself more valuable to you? How can I improve my performance so I can help the company reach its goals and objectives? How can I improve my value in the marketplace?" Once your boss has had time to get over the shock, listen carefully to what he or she has to say. You've given them an opportunity to be perfectly honest and frank with you. If you own your own business, ask your customers point blank, "How could I make my services more valuable to you? What is it you need or want? What are you willing to pay? What will you buy from me?" If you're ready, the boss, try this tactic in reverse to get your employees and subordinates behind you. Ask them how their working conditions could be improved so they can become more effective and happier employees. A few years ago, I was thinking about selling my home. the prices were rising rapidly in my area, which would leave me with a tidy profit. On top of that, I had a very interesting opportunity to own a beautiful piece of property out of state. Things on the new property had not yet been finalized, so I simply decided to stick a for sale sign in the front of my house to see if the interest was there at the price I wanted. Like it or not, your success or failure in life will ultimately depend a great deal on your ability to sell. Whether you actually make your living selling tangible products like computers or cars, as millions of Americans do, or you're looking for a new job, selling yourself is of vital importance. Even if you're never involved in retail or wholesale merchandising during your entire life, you must sell every day you're alive. You have to sell someone on your unique abilities in order to get hired in the first place. You have to sell your worth and talents to your boss in order to move up the corporate ladder. You have to sell yourself to your customers, your staff, and even your friends. When you get accepted into university, marry, or take out a new car loan, you have to sell yourself first. Almost every action in life revolves around selling of some sort. The first step in selling yourself to others is developing a winning attitude. Success depends largely not only on your attitude towards others, but also your attitude towards yourself. How's your attitude? Is it positive, optimistic, and happy? Or negative, pessimistic, and aimed at defeat? Have you ever noticed how people who view the same situation with totally different attitudes usually obtain totally different results? Take, for example, the small boy who many years ago stood at the edge of the city of San Francisco. He stood on the banks of the beautiful bay and looked down at an army of men and machines. As small boys often are, he was naturally inquisitive and slowly wandered down to a group of three men who were welding a series of huge metal girders. Upon reaching the first man, he asked him what he was doing. The man gruffly replied he was working for his lousy paycheck. The boy wandered over to the second man and asked the same question. He replied in a gentler tone, but with an equal lack of enthusiasm, that he was welding together some pieces of metal. Upon reaching the third worker, the man looked up and smiled happily at the young boy. The boy asked his question again, to which the man replied, "I'm building the greatest bridge the world has ever seen." With that, the boy's face lit up in wonder, and he went along on his way. Three men, from similar backgrounds, with identical jobs entrusted to them, were working the same hours, in the same conditions, and for the same pay. Yet each had a totally different attitude towards his work. You've all seen examples of this in daily life, and you know the ones which will be successful in anything and everything they try to do. I've never met anyone with a 9-to-5 attitude who's been successful. You know the type of person I mean, the person who comes in at 9 on the dot and spends 15 minutes getting ready to work. They take an extra 15 minutes at lunch and frequent coffee breaks during the day. At 4:45, they're getting ready to leave, and at 5, they're out of the door with the only burst of speed and enthusiasm seen the entire day. They bitch about having to work late once a month and always feel that the boss is exploiting them in some way. This is the type of person who thinks that life owes them, and the person who exerts the least amount of effort wins. This type of attitude is as prevalent in unsuccessful people as it is lacking in those who reach the very top. Possessing a good attitude has a great deal to do with success. Successful people look for ways to get more work done in less time because they know this will have a payoff. Successful people know they have to give more if they want to get more. Attitudes are usually learned from our parents when we're young. This is great if your parents had a good attitude, but it's not so good if they didn't. If your parents had a prejudicial attitude towards a certain group of people, then the chances are at least you started out with the same type of attitude. Over time, if you met someone from that group who did you a good turn and became your friend, you might have changed your attitude. You could also have had such a poor attitude towards this group of people that you never let your attitude change. Attitudes are formed in three ways. Firstly, from beliefs or knowledge. Secondly, from feelings and emotions. And thirdly, from tendencies to act in specific ways based on knowledge and emotion. If you realize you have a poor attitude towards people or work, then you need to address your attitude and make some adjustments. Otherwise, selling yourself will be impossible. Have you ever wondered why so many Korean, Vietnamese, and other Asian immigrant families who come here with nothing are so successful? It's because the Asian culture has a positive, built-in attitude towards hard work. They come to this country, work extremely hard, and surprise, surprise, they get ahead faster than people who've even been born here. The first step in making sure your attitudes are consistent with those of successful people is to make a quick and honest review of them. Do you have a good attitude towards yourself? Do you have a good attitude towards the work you do? Do you have a good attitude towards those with whom you work? Do you have a good attitude towards your boss? Do you have a good attitude towards your customers? Do you have a good attitude towards other people in general, regardless of color or creed? Do you have a good attitude towards life and the rewards it holds for you? If the answer to any of these questions is no, break it down further and ask yourself why you have this attitude. What shaped your thinking into this mold, even though you know it may well be counterproductive? People who live their dreams don't let problems stand in their way. They can't. In order to make it big, you must face countless roadblocks and obstacles on your path to the top that must be circumvented in order to reach your goals. It's at this stage, even armed with goals, strategies, and a plan, most people become derailed. It's easy to jump out of bed every morning and rush to work when things are going well. It's not so easy when you're faced with some of the more serious problems of life. Handling problems is just like handling the objection in a selling situation, because once they're solved, they become stepping stones on the road to success rather than obstacles in your way. To put it another way, think of each problem you encounter as a gate on the road to the top, and once you've figured out how to open the gate, you'll be that much closer to achieving your goals. Unfortunately, once the majority of people find the gate is locked, and they don't have a key in their pocket that will open the lock, they simply turn around and go home. The people who make it big in life never let the fact that they don't have a key hold them back. They try to pick the lock. They attempt to climb over the gate. They try to squeeze under it or even go right through the middle of it. They may even try to break it down. Or, when all else fails, they circumvent the gate by finding another route that will take them where they want to go. Often the knowledge they gain from solving problems or the fact that they are forced to choose another route actually speeds up their progress rather than hinders it. The key to avoiding your problems is to step out of your conventional thought process and become more creative. People who fail to make it big look at a problem, let's say lack of capital, and say, "I can't do this until I have more money." At this point, all thinking stops and their minds shut down. It shuts down simply because that is what it's been instructed to do. An urgent message has been sent to the brain that says, "Don't think about this problem until we get more money and can proceed." The brain says, "Fine," and shuts down. It shuts down despite the fact that this may mean working for months to save the money. It may mean getting a second job or working overtime. But whatever they choose to do will never be the answer, because people who handle problems in this way are always one problem away from starting their journey to the top. Even if they solve their present problem by saving for 6 more months, another problem will arise and they'll be stopped again. People who are successful and find a lack of capital look at the problem and say, "How can I get this money? What if I did this or that in order to raise the money I need?" They study how to solve the problem instead of simply looking at the problem and hoping it will somehow go away. When you're faced with a problem, you must quickly analyze the problem and make sure that it doesn't get any bigger. What is a problem? That in itself is an interesting question. One person's problem may be another person's opportunity or yet another's routine action. For example, imagine you're in a small plane with 2 friends returning from a fishing trip. Suddenly, the pilot has a heart attack and becomes unconscious. Is that a problem? It certainly is for the sick man, but not necessarily for you. You might be able to fly the plane, or maybe the 3rd man is an airline captain. In this case, one of you would simply take over the controls and land the plane. If you happen to be a doctor, you may recognize that the victim has had a mild heart attack and is now breathing normally, so the imminent danger is over. If, of course, you're not a doctor and no one can fly the plane, you have a problem. A big problem, but you see what I mean. What often appears to be an insurmountable problem to one person can simply disappear when seen through the eyes of another. It may sound funny, but many people set out to solve a problem and in their enthusiasm solve the wrong problem. Thus, they leave the root problem untouched and still operating in their lives. Much time is wasted solving problems only to discover later they weren't the real problem. Famous bandleader Count Basie became upset that the piano on which he played was constantly out of tune, and he told the club owner that he would not return to the club again until the piano was fixed. 1. The basic needs, such as food and water. 2. The social needs, such as love and the feeling of security. And 3. Self-actualization, the need to fulfill one's unique potential. The true source of an individual's motivation often does not appear until they're questioned. For example, let's take the man who says he's motivated by money. When you ask him what he would do with the money, he said he would buy a new Ferrari. You ask him why he wants a Ferrari, and he has to think for a minute before answering. He tells you that he wants one because people who have Ferraris are successful people. They park them up front at restaurants, and besides, the neighbors would have a fit of envy. What was really important to this man was not the money or the Ferrari. Instead, it was the feeling of respect and importance he really craved. What motivates a woman to pay large sums of money for tiny bottles of perfume? Because it smells good is always the first answer, but is it really the smell that motivates her into action? Not really. The smell of a perfume that costs $200 does not differ that much from one that costs $50. The woman is not motivated by the smell, but by the feelings she expects that smell to bring her. Beauty, self-esteem, love, and self-confidence. The greater the price of the perfume, the greater the feeling she associates with it. By asking yourself a series of questions, you can discover what your true motivation is in life. You can use this to create pressure on yourself to perform. Wait a minute, you say. What do you mean I can create pressure on myself? That's what I want to get rid of. Well, that is not necessarily true. Not all pressure is bad. Some pressure is good. Good pressure is the type of pressure you use to motivate yourself into action. Let me give you a good example of pressure. You decided you're going to be the number one salesperson in your division. At your weekly meeting, you stand up in front of your boss and announce this to everyone. Now you've created pressure on yourself to meet these goals. You don't lie, right? You don't want to look stupid in front of your boss and your co-workers, right? So, what are your options now? Only one. Get into gear and get moving. You're going to use the pressure you've created to motivate you into action. If you succeed in reaching your goal, you will gain the praise of your boss, satisfying your need for self-esteem. You will also gain financially and avoid the pain of looking bad and losing self-esteem in front of your peers. Just to make sure everyone heard you the first time, you might want to mention it more than once. If you're a manager, you will find this is an excellent method of getting results for your employees. Instead of having you place pressure on them, help them create their own positive pressure. This will pay off in their careers as well as yours. Practice putting positive pressure on yourself and encourage those around you to do the same. There are two types of way in which you can motivate yourself or others towards accomplishing the goals you desire to reach. First, there is positive motivation, in which you promise yourself a new car, a home, or lifestyle in order to get yourself excited and motivated to achieve. In this case, you are motivated by the rewards you will receive for your efforts. In the case of negative motivation, a person focuses his thoughts and energies on all the bad things that will happen if they do not achieve greater success. If you don't work harder, your boss may fire you. If you don't find a better job, you may lose your home and you will never be able to send your kids to the college of your dreams. In this case, the person is driven to achieve success by moving away from failure as opposed to moving towards success. Refer back now to your workbook and look at your number one goal for this year. List 5 positive events that will occur if and when you achieve your number one goal in a timely manner. Now list 5 negative or painful things that will come into your life if you fail to reach this goal. You should now have 5 negative and 5 positive reasons to achieve your number one goal for the year. Which type of reason gives you the greatest sense of motivation? Is it positive or negative? Both types of motivation can be extremely effective in helping you reach your goals, and there's no reason why you can't use both to get you in gear. It doesn't matter whether you use positive or negative motivation, just as long as you get motivated to achieve more in your life. You should be able to identify which type of motivation works best for you, and then use some of the following techniques in order to heighten that sense of motivation. The more motivated you are to get ahead, the faster you will achieve your goals. The great majority of people who grew up in an average sort of way find it difficult to develop the burning desire and motivation necessary to reach the top. One reason many people are not highly motivated to achieve the most life can bring is very simple. They have no experience in the pain, anger, and desperation of poverty that has driven so many people to the top. And their taste of the best things in life is limited to a half hour of Robin Leach on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. They are lost in the comfort zone and they lead average American lives. In order to develop a positive motivation, you need to see what you are missing and experience some of the sights, sound, smells, and feelings of success. How can you truly get excited and motivated about something if you have no idea how it will improve your life? How does it feel to play on the world's best golf courses, ski the Alps, or sail a yacht in Bermuda? The future is there for those who take it. Eleanor Roosevelt. At the end of my very first seminar, which was aimed at small business owners, five different people came up to me to tell me how much they'd enjoyed the seminar. Each then proceeded to tell me in detail how they had been planning for several years to do exactly what I was doing. Two of the five even suggested I could improve the quality of my seminar if I allowed them to help me. I asked both to send me a letter detailing their basic ideas. Neither letter ever arrived. At my next seminar several weeks later, a similar thing happened. Only this time, six people approached me either immediately after the seminar or in private later that evening. Since then, hardly a seminar goes by where at least one person doesn't tell me exactly the same thing. I've been thinking of doing seminars on such and such, they say. Are you an expert on that subject, I ask. Oh yes, they say, I've been involved in that subject for 20 years. Then why don't you, I ask. It's at this point people seem to get truly creative. If most people put half as much effort into figuring out creative solutions to their problems as they do in coming up with reasons to procrastinate, there'd be absolutely no chance of failure. To my knowledge, none of the people who ever told me about their plans have actually gone ahead with them. Have you ever been sitting in a coffee shop or a bar and overheard two people talking about the things they were going to do just as soon as they had the money, some extra time, they quit their lousy job, they got a lucky break, they find someone else to help them, etc.? There's simply no more fatal disease to success than procrastination. Those cancerous little statements that kill. Statements like, I was tired, I'll do it later, I'll start when the holidays are over. When I finish this course, then I'm going to be ready to get going. I just felt like doing something else today. I'll get to it next week, next month, or next year. I'll do it when I've saved up some more money. You can find these and 1,001 other excuses just like them on the lips of the millions who are not happy with their position in life. They are the wannabes trapped in a mediocre life they really want to leave. Unfortunately for them, it seems that they are not unhappy enough to destroy their tendency towards procrastination. You can always find reasons why you should not start to do something right now. And if you give your brain equal time to think how, you can find just as many reasons to do it now. Go, start, lights, camera, action. You cannot reach your goals without taking direct and massive action to get you there. So why do people procrastinate? What is stopping you from taking action towards your dreams? Dreams don't change the world. Actions change the world. procrastination really goes back to poor planning. If you've correctly laid out your goals and the actions needed to achieve them, there should be no reason not to move forward. You have clearly identified the things you wish to achieve and the steps you needed to accomplish them. You have set a timetable, a checkup system, and a reward system for reaching your short-term goals. You have no reason not to take action. It's usually when people have not sat down and planned a course that they procrastinate. They procrastinate simply because the thought of leaving where they are now and moving forward terrifies them. It terrifies them because they do not know what they will encounter along the way. They have not faced up to their fears. It's like having to walk through a pitch-black tunnel full of open manholes to get to the other side. You have no idea what you will encounter, and so you don't enter the tunnel. People who've completed the planning stages boldly step forward into the blackness. They know they can expect manholes, but they're confident they will know how to deal with them when they come. They know what is on the other side of the tunnel, and they know that it's worth reaching. They know the pain of not reaching these wonderful goals is far too great to stand around and do nothing. They also know the rewards are great, and if they stick to their plan, in the long run, there is no chance of failure. Have you written down your goals yet? Have you written down a list of people you need to meet? Have you written down a list of actions and the dates by which they should be accomplished? If the answer is no to any of these questions, then there's a very good chance that you're not ready to take the action needed to propel you to the top. Turn to your workbook now, or if you're driving, make it the first thing you do at the office or home today. Complete your master plan for success before you go on. It's amazing how the simple act of defining a clear plan and strategy will improve your life instantly. As I write this program and put down my thoughts on paper, I'm filled with an immense feeling of excitement. By writing about the techniques I've used, it heightens my awareness of them and makes my own goals and strategies crystal clear. A clear picture of the ultimate goal and the actions needed to achieve it will allow you to triumph over procrastination.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Those were the immortal words broadcast to the people of Britain on June 4, 1940, by Prime Minister Winston Churchill, only a week after the evacuation of 750,000 men from Dunkirk on the coast of France. The rest of the countries in Europe had fallen with alarming speed to Hitler's war machine. The Nazis stood just outside of Paris and would soon be looking at London itself, across the 20 miles that is the English Channel. At this time, the whole fate of Western Europe lay on the British. Despite the devastation of all the other armies in Europe and seemingly hopeless odds, Winston Churchill stood defiantly in the face of the enemy. He believed if he could hang on long enough, something would happen that would change the course of the war in Britain's favor. His indomitable spirit and bold-faced persistence in a cause he believed in was the single most important factor in the entire war. Many of the other top cabinet ministers were later to say that without his constant encouragement and dogged persistence, Britain would never have held out until America entered the war and changed the course in the favor of the Allies. Churchill has been described by many as the greatest man of the 20th century, and yet Churchill was far from successful in much of his early life. Despite flashes of brilliance and courage, he was dished out more than an average share of disappointments and setbacks. He was hopeless at mathematics and had to take his entrance exam 3 times before being accepted into the military. Even then, his scores were so poor he had to go into the cavalry instead of the army as he'd hoped. Before reaching his post as Prime Minister, he was defeated many times in local elections. He lost his seat in Parliament, Britain's equivalent of Congress, not once but several times. After being removed from the position as First Lord of the Admiralty during the First World War, following the devastating loss of a major battle, he was quoted as saying to friends, "I'm finished." The difference was that after a few days to regroup, he knew he was far from finished. He knew that no matter how bleak things looked at the moment, greater days lay ahead of him.
He knew that with persistence and patience, his finest hour was still to come. This trait of persistence is found in all successful people and is crucial to getting ahead in life. According to former President Calvin Coolidge, nothing takes the place of persistence. And if history is any judge, he's certainly right. Almost all the world's great success stories are drawn from the ashes of failure or despair. People who are fired from one company only to persist and rise rapidly to the top in another. People like Lee Iacocca, fired by Henry Ford, only to be made president of Chrysler and save it from total ruin in a matter of only a few months after taking over. Later, he became a national business hero and the ultimate proof that success is the best revenge. Generals humiliated in battle only to return with the war's decisive victory. Leaders like Lincoln and Churchill, who on the verge of utter despair, could still summon the courage, strength, and persistence to move entire nations to victory when none seemed possible. Persistence is the one ingredient that truly separates those at the top from the also-rans and the wannabes. Like all the other ingredients, it's a simple one to learn, and putting it into action is as easy as deciding to simply do it. This simple ingredient has been quoted and demonstrated as the reason for success by those at the very top more than any other factor. From Washington to Reagan and Edison to Einstein, this one lesson can be found in the biographies of every person in the world who ever made it big. The original demonstration of this quality is credited to a Scottish warrior by the name of Robert the Bruce, or more specifically to a spider whose acquaintance he made. Having fled the might of the oncoming armies prior to the Battle of Bannockburn, he was hiding in a cave, tired, defeated, and depressed. It's a place to which many of us have been in one way or another. He had failed, things had not gone as planned, and the future seemed hazy at best. We've all been there at one time or another, down and almost out for the count, faced with bills, problems, and an uncertain future. What really separates the winners from the losers in this world is how you react at that point in your life. Any fool can get up and go to work when things are going great. It's when things are not so good that the real winners and losers in life are truly decided. After sleeping for several hours, he woke up to see a spider had spun a giant web that almost reached across the entire mouth of the cave. Before the spider could complete its task, a strong gust of wind blew the web into pieces. Undeterred, the spider climbed back to the top of the cave and began its work again. Three times the wind howled through the cave and destroyed the web. Yet each time the spider climbed back to the top and started spinning the web again. Robert watched this spider for hours as it spun its web, and he searched his very soul for answers to overcome the seemingly insurmountable strength of his enemy. From this simple scene, Robert the Bruce saw the answer so clearly and simply that he drew from it immense strength and purpose. The following day, he rounded up his weary men and led them back into battle, where they defeated the enemy despite being vastly outnumbered. The spider's message rings out true today, just as loudly and clearly as it did a few hundred years ago. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. All the best people fail. If you know a thing or two about baseball, then you'll probably already know the answer to this little piece of trivia. If not, the answer may surprise you. Either way, it illustrates the point to perfection. Who had the most strikeouts in baseball history? The answer, of course, is Babe Ruth. But think about that. The game's all-time legend failed to hit the ball more times than any other player in history, well over 1,300 times.